Welcome. Judge Manning and I are delighted this morning to welcome Judge Griesbach from the Eastern District of Wisconsin District Court in Green Bay to sit with us by designation today. Welcome, Judge Griesbach.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I'll call the first case of the morning, which is Absher v. Moments Meadows. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This case presents a quintessentially devastating distortion and abuse of the False Claims Act civil action. A crippling financial judgment has been imposed in a case where it is impossible to discern how many false claims there actually were, what those claims may have consisted of, when they occurred, how they damaged the government, or in what way they were false. In every respect, the False Claims Act criteria have not been met. As presented to the jury, the plaintiff's case was all about inadequate or substandard medical services. The pretrial statement, which governs this case and governs this appeal, provides that plaintiffs claim that the services were so inadequate as to be tantamount to be no services or substantially diminished services. They, as argued to the jury, plaintiff's counsel repeatedly referred to a pattern of substandard care. And the jury was instructed repeatedly with respect to worthless services, diminished staffing, inadequate equipment, and so on and so forth. It was all about the standard of care. In the first instance, this case is barred jurisdictionally by sections E4 and E3 of the section 3730 of the False Claims Act, because they are based, the claims, the assertions, which provide the basis for this case, were based on government reports as a consequence of surveys, visits by the Department of Public Health of the state of Illinois to the facility. They visited 117 times, and in 30-some of those visits, 37 I believe, they found deficiencies of some sort, which is the part of the process. No institution is perfect. The Code of Federal Regulations with respect to Medicare and Medicaid set up a finely reticulated regime of administrative oversight of these facilities so that inspectors appear, and in most of the cases, they appear without announcement. They just show up. In a few of the cases, there were some warnings, but in most cases, they just show up. In most of the cases, they found the facility was functioning appropriately. In some of the cases, they found deficiencies with respect to the facility, and as a result of the administrator's visits, those surveys, there are correction policies or correction programs, correction plans submitted to the government. Sometimes, in some instances, there were fines because there was substandard or deficiencies of some sort. But that is the process. And the chart on page 27 of the Moments brief lists each of the instances in which the allegations of this case, the things that came into evidence with respect to this case, this is on page 27 of the opening brief, lists the alleged deficiencies and lists the itemization in the survey reports by the Illinois Department of Public Works. And you'll see that there's an exact parallel of the complaints with respect to what was going on in the facility and the allegations or reports that the public officials came up with respect to the facility.
Right, and there's no question that there's substantial overlap between the content of the inspection reports, which were a significant part of the proofs in this case, as I understand the record, and the core of the False Claims Act claim in this case. But the response of the plaintiffs is that the gravamen of this claim is concealment, and that somehow gets around the jurisdictional bar.
Well, the concealment is, we go back to the joint pretrial statement and the way the case was presented to the court, at the trial court. concealment wasn't an issue in the jury instructions. It wasn't an issue in the arguments to the jury. It wasn't mentioned in the joint pretrial statement. This is a theory that has been brought up on appeal to avoid the jurisdictional bar, but it is not how the case was presented. There is no evidence that was put in before the jury with respect to the case that was presented at the trial. You can look through the entire closing argument of the plaintiff's counsel, and I don't see the word, unless I overlooked something, I did not see the word concealment. That's a theory that did not come up during the trial, and that wasn't the thrust of the case, and there's no jury instruction. That concealment theory was not presented to the jury. The entire case, if you look at the jury instructions, was based upon the allegation that the services rendered were so deficient as to be inadequate, or to use the phrase, worthless, although the trial judge didn't believe they were worthless. The plaintiff's lawyer didn't believe they were worthless. He even said in his closing argument that you don't really have to find that they were actually of no value. The jury obviously didn't think that the services rendered were worthless because the damage award was 1/11th of what the actual amounts paid to the facility from the government.
Well, that's part of the problem with this case, that the verdict is hard to decipher, and it's hard to decipher standing alone and with respect to the way the jury was instructed, because the worthless services theory of the case didn't really define what it means for services to be worthless as it relates to a false claim. And so we can't really know what the jury was finding on that point. But the problem I have with your position on that theory of the case is that it looks like, and correct me if I'm misreading the exchange during the jury instruction conference, but it looks like there wasn't a focused objection made to the inadequacy of that instruction, or was there? Perhaps I'm misreading the record.
The record is not really crystal clear with respect to this, but it's the plaintiff's obligation, the relator's obligation, to see that the jury is instructed in a manner that's consistent with the False Claims Act. There wasn't a request for instructions that were any more clear than what they really got.
Well, do we know who wrote this instruction? Was this the plaintiff's instruction?
I think that there's a combination of what was submitted to the... I don't know, really know actually the answer to that, but as I understand it from reading the record, it looked like it was a combination of submissions from the plaintiff's counsel and objections and the usual colloquy that takes place in a district court with respect to the instructions. What we do know is what the jury was instructed, and it was all with respect to inadequate staffing, equipment maintenance, equipment, and dysfunctioning governing body and that sort of thing. But the judge was struggling this because he didn't think that the services were worthless. He said at one point in a colloquy, and this is on pages A527 and A528 of the appendix, he said, in other words, so that if Uncle Sam paid Moments $200 and they only got $120 worth of value, that Moments defrauded them of $80 worth of services, they'd be therefore entitled to $140 worth of damages. It's a little unclear here. But what he was saying is that you're going to be entitled to somehow to recover the difference between the value of the services and the amount paid for the services, so that theoretically, under this sort of confused theory, that if the government received $1 less or $10 less out of 100 than what they were entitled to, that somehow that would be a False Claims Act. But is this... Excuse me.
Well, that whole... colloquy in the record really relates to the measure of damages and not the fundamental theory of the claim, and that's the problem that I have with it. I think the jury was misinstructed on the fundamental theory of the claim to the extent that it was based on worthless services. And we've rejected the diminished value theory anyway. So it's not clear to me what the jury was being asked to decide with respect to the worthless services theory that it was given.
Precisely, Your Honor. That's my point at the very beginning. We don't know how many false claims. This court has required that there be a particularized claim under the False Claims Act, which was responded to by a payment by the government. That's the Gross case and the Cruz case and so forth. None of that is here. The so-called DHS forms, there was only one of those admitted into evidence. There was no proof that anything in that form was false. All of those other forms are not in evidence, so there's therefore no proof of or any evidence that those DHS forms were deficient or false or inadequate in some way. The government, the forms that the facility submits to the government for payment are called HFS 1156 under Medicaid or UB 92 forms under Medicare. Those billing forms are not in evidence. They're certainly not in evidence as false. The so-called correction plans, there was no submission that any of the correction plans were false. And with respect to the patient's charts, if you go that far, those charts weren't submitted to the government, of course. But there's no evidence with respect to those charts that they were false, except in two instances where there are allegations of falsification of charts. But you can't discern a pattern of fraud or base a False Claims Act judgment on a couple of anecdotes. This court has said that, so has other courts.
Well, there's 1,729 false claims. That's, I guess what you're saying is there's no identification of those.
No, no one can figure out what
those...
And yet
they use that as the multiple for $11,000. And that's, I'm trying to discern, I always thought in the QITOM or QITOM, whatever we want to call it, that there has to be something that they disclose that nobody else knows. That's what a whistleblower is. Now, this seems not to be the case here. It seems to be for an eight-year period. It seems like a big malpractice or some kind of a claim.
Yes, Judge Mannion, I think that's exactly what this is. This is a malpractice case without plaintiffs, so that any recovery doesn't go to anybody that received any allegedly deficient medical care. Masquerading as a False Claims Act case. Those 1,729 alleged false claims, we don't know what they are.
It could be something relatively small, couldn't it?
Accidentally
spill coffee on somebody or something.
Pardon me?
Where I'm just looking at something that's worth $11,000 each.
Well,
that perplexes me.
That would be the penalty amount, somewhere between $5,000 and $11,000 under the statute. That's one of the major problems with this case, is that the government and the plaintiff's counsel allege that, well, it really doesn't matter. The jury could have thought this, the jury could have thought that, but it really was about alleged inefficiency or insufficiency of the care that was rendered and alleged violations of the Medicare regulations. But the Medicare regulations specifically say that deficiencies in compliance are not a bar to payment. The Medicare regulations, and they're in the briefs, referred to in the briefs, they might be lost dentures or a failure to provide a no-smoking section in the dining room. There's all kinds of things where there might be a deficiency that's spotted by the federal government, or by the state government or the federal government. And the point here is that the allegations are based upon information that's was in the public domain, was publicly disclosed. That, the Supreme Court said in the Schindler Elevator case, is a bar which must be interpreted broadly, because Medicare, particularly Medicare and Medicaid case, these can be abused. If institutions can be shut down or destroyed as a result of some allegation that something wasn't done right. So we have 1,729 what? We don't know what there's 1,729 of. All we do know is that the paperwork that was submitted to the government was not demonstrated to be false. There's not a single thing that was submitted to the government for payment that is demonstrated in evidence to have been false. So we don't know where the 1729 comes from.
But wasn't there evidence that these MDS forms, which contain the language about the information in the form being certified as correct and constituting a condition for payment, wasn't there evidence that those forms were submitted on a periodic basis in accordance with regulations or regulatory requirements for each patient? And maybe that's where the 1729 came from?
Maybe, but the problem is that we don't know where the 1729 comes from. That's not the number of forms that were, those forms that were actually submitted. There was only one of those forms offered into evidence.
Well, right, but that was as proof of what the forms generally contain. And then, as I understand it, there was evidence, and maybe it wasn't connected up, or the jury wasn't instructed properly. I'm really concerned about the jury instructions in this case across the board, but I think there was evidence that these forms are submitted for every patient on a periodic basis.
That's correct.
Okay. So we do know that. So.
But they weren't false. There's no evidence that they were false. The one that's in evidence wasn't proven to be false, and there's no evidence that the remainders were false. The reason for those forms are to determine how much will be paid to the facility on a per diem basis. So if you report the conditions, it's how long the patient is in the facility and what conditions the patient is suffering from. So in fact, it's an incentive to the institution to over-report the problems with the particular patient. But there's no allegation that was over-reporting of the patient's conditions in those forms, nor is there any proof that there was any underreporting, which would be against the interest of the institution to underreport the severity of the patient's condition. There's no incentive for the institution to do that. But the jurisdictional bar will take care of this case. The E4 provision will take care of this case because the material that forms the basis of the allegations is all essentially all in those reports. That bars this claim. The other E3 bars this claim too, because there is this reticulated system of government inspections, fines, corrective notices, and the government has the power to shut the facility down as far as Medicare or Medicaid is concerned. It didn't do that. And so that's the E3 provision. So those two provisions bar this case. But then when you get into the merits, this court has required that it's called the False Claims Act because there have to be false claims submitted to the government. There is no evidence and no submission of any particular claim, piece of paper, or statement to the federal government with respect to Medicare or Medicaid that was false.
Well, the form actually says, I understand that this information, and this is the MDS form, I understand that this information is used as a basis for ensuring that residents receive appropriate and quality care and as a basis for payment from federal funds. I further understand that payment of such federal funds and continued participation in government-funded health care programs is conditioned on the accuracy and truthfulness of this information, and that I may be personally subject to or may be subject to, may subject my organization to substantial fines and penalties if not. Now, isn't the defense or the plaintiff's argument that they did present evidence that the quality of care was not appropriate, that the residents did not receive appropriate quality care, and a reasonable inference, they would argue, as I understand it, is that, therefore, this form is wrong, saying that they did receive such appropriate and quality care, and it was a condition of payment.
Well, those forms have a limited purpose. Yes, they did, no question they contain that language. But one would have to prove, so this takes it from an express certification to the government into this whole area of implied certification, that somehow because you
were
identifying...
This is an express certification.
Yes, but is it...
Of quality, that the of appropriate, that the patients, residents receive appropriate and quality care.
Yes,
and I realize they only submitted one, but as Judge Sykes was pointing out, they submitted evidence, as I understand it, that these were regularly submitted as a condition.
They were regularly submitted. They list the conditions that the patient is suffering from. There's no information in the file, in the record, that suggests that that was false. And I want to close with this point by saying that you have to, where's the 1729 come from? You have to have 1729 false claims to justify this, and you don't have that number. You don't know that they were false in any particular particular. We're talking about an 8-year period. There were definitely incidents of allegations of insufficient care, but those are not, don't, aren't tied to any particular form.
But is there a record of the defendant asking for a verdict that would have provided the specificity that you're now claiming is missing?
Again, this is the plaintiff's obligation. The jurisdictional provisions are...
Aren't things waived if a defendant in a trial doesn't raise an objection to a jury instruction to a verdict?
I think the record is clear that the defendant in this case was objecting to the fact that the case was submitted on this basis and raising the jurisdictional objections. Since my time for rebuttal is eating away, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time, may.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson.
Good morning, and may it please the court. An honest but negligent nursing home would not be exposed to False Claims Act liability under the district court's decision. The critical facts in this case are that Moment's administrators hid nurses' logs every single time that Medicare surveyors arrived, even randomly, at the facility. Testimony was they did so because they felt that what was in those logs would be incriminating. There was specific evidence that Moment's administrators gave direct orders to falsify medical records in cases where the correct notation would show that Moment's was at fault. In particular, nurses were told to suppress reports of scabies infections. This is a highly contagious condition that afflicts many nursing homes that involves a very expensive and labor-intensive procedure. You have to steam out the room, quarantine the patient, and isolate the laundry until the condition passes. And instead of doing what Medicare required them to do, nurses were told not to record the scabies symptoms, but simply to administer scabicide cream. And they communicated with each other about this alternative treatment to scabies in the very logs that were hidden away when the surveyors arrived. In the record, you will see at appendix page 1176, this is the second to last page in volume 4 of the appendix, a graph that shows the explosion of the scabies outbreak of March 2002 that lasted for 9 months.
Yes. It was the subject of inspection reports, which were publicly known.
No, well, the inspections that ultimately found that there was a scabies epidemic were publicly disclosed. What was not publicly disclosed to the surveyors was the fraud that caused the scabies explosion to happen. Namely, I mean, that sure, when all 100 residents of the nursing home are afflicted with scabies, and the relators, nurses Absher and Nurse Mitchell, call the regular public health people in, at that point, the government knows that there's a scabies problem.
Did the government continue to pay on behalf of these patients when it knew of the very problem you claimed they were trying to hide?
It knew there was scabies. They didn't know that the emergent symptoms of scabies had been hidden. In other words, if you suppress knowledge of the scabies, what's going to happen is there's going to be a much larger outbreak down the road than if you honestly report it when it first comes up.
But they didn't regard the epidemic of scabies in the nursing home as rendering the services provided by Moments worthless.
No,
and
because
it's regarded as a false certification either.
That's true, because it is conceivable that an honest nursing home might, for whatever reason, still suffer a scabies epidemic. But that's not true for Moments. The scabies epidemic of 2002 was a proximate result of the fact that scabies was hushed up in the 6 months before that period. And that's what the surveyors didn't know. And that's what they would have known if they had been able to read the nurses' logs for the 6 months before this explosion, where nurses talked to each other about using scabicide creams and so on instead of steaming out the rooms. So that's why the public disclosure bar does not resolve the case, because although the government knew about the bad patient care, they knew about the problem, they didn't know the extent to which the fraud had contributed to the problem.
Okay, so what's the false certification?
The false, one of the things on the MDS form requires the nursing home to check a box and notify the government if any patients have a skin condition, like scabies. And the relator's expert at page 1000 of the appendix went through all the medical documents and concluded that where you have an ultimate data point where the government discovers that there has been scabies, when you track back through the medical records, what you would expect to find would be a sequence of entries that show the emergence of the symptom, the summoning of the doctor, and the treatment. The expert concluded on her review of all the medical records that there was no such correlation at Moments. In other words, when Medicare people were finally called in and found scabies all over the facility, when you go back through the records, you won't find any of the entries that would show the actual emergence of those symptoms. And that's all stuff that should have been recorded on the MDS form. And the jury could properly infer that during the months prior to the 2002 scabies epidemic, that the nursing home was refusing to check the box on the MDS form that would have notified the government earlier that there was emergent scabies.
Did the expert actually look at all the MDS forms that were filed during the relevant time period?
Yes, the expert reviewed all the medical records and gave her summary testimony to the jury about that.
Well, did she say that they contained falsehoods?
She said that there was no correlation between the ultimate record of scabies treatment and the prior and any prior records about its emergence.
I don't know what that means. I'm asking you whether the expert testified that these many MDS forms were false.
She didn't use the number 1,729.
However, she use any number?
No, but we know that there were 5 MDS forms filed for each resident per quarter. And since there were about 100 residents in the facility at this time, that means you have about 500 forms per quarter. And over 4 quarters, that's 2,000 forms.
Okay.
The jury could have easily...
Did she testify to that?
No, she didn't give a number
of 1729. Did anybody testify to that?
No.
I'm not talking about the specific 1729. Was there any evidence about how many forms were submitted, MDS forms were submitted to the government, and was there any testimony or other evidence that certain numbers of them, whether it's the 1729 that the jury latched onto or some other number, contained falsehoods with respect to this scabies epidemic?
The jury knew that there were 5 per quarter per resident, and they were told by the expert that the medical records prior to the epidemic had scabies suppressed from them, did not have correlating prior entries about scabies.
Okay, so we don't have any evidence about how many MDS forms were false.
No, the jury found that based on a preponderance of the evidence.
How many did you argue?
We presented the evidence that there were 5 per resident per quarter.
And you didn't suggest to the jury what percentage of them would have been false based on the scabies?
The jury had a graph that showed how many ultimate scabies cases there were in the facility and probably reasoned from those numbers.
Well, what was your theory? I mean, usually when closing arguments are made, you present your conceptualization of the fraud to the jury. So what did you argue with respect to the numbers?
At pages 1098 through 1100 of the appendix in the jury argument, we argued about the silencing about scabies, about the deception of surveyors, and argued that this was the proximate cause of the bad patient outcomes.
What period of time did that include? You keep referring to 6 months.
Well, the scabies outbreak was noted starting March of 2002. Linda Mitchell, the relator, testified that in September or October of 2001, she was instructed not to make records about scabies in the medical records, and that this was a great concern to her because she thought that doctors were not being told about the emergent scabies symptoms there.
Yeah, that's the problem, but doesn't this extend for 8 years?
The jury certainly found liability based on a smaller subset of time and care than the entire 8 years. There were $33 million billed over 8 years. The jury only found $3 million worth of damages, which, by the way, if you look
what at... What did you argue with respect to damages?
Right. Well, I mean, as to damages, we argued that for a model that would have given $9 million in damages, and the jury awarded a third of that. But what was in the record, for instance, was that the jury was given a monthly breakdown of the Medicare billings during 2002 at the time of the scabies outbreak. And the monthly breakdown shows $300,000 to $500,000 of billing per month. And if the jury decided that 9 months of that time was effectively worthless services that was proximately caused by the false certification, that gets you to a figure that's very close to the $3 million.
How can you say the services were worthless, even with a scabies outbreak? I mean, isn't a great portion of nursing home care, isn't it custodial care, especially on days like today, you're in a warm place, you're giving meals, you're cared for, clothing, things like that. I mean, there's a lot of services, and these are per diem. I understand that Medicare bills on a per diem per patient basis. How can you say that the services provided, even in the face of a scabies outbreak at some point in time, which is, as I understand it, is not uncommon in nursing homes, that these are the types of things that you need to be aware of because they can occur. But even other things, like the hot water incident or the other...
Well, the critical factor is that it was knowing. And this is the thing that even on appeal...
But how does the knowledge affect the value of the service?
Because it goes to the intentionality of the fraud. It's not honest negligence, but a deliberate attempt to deceive Medicare surveyors when the nursing home knows that it's not giving the services that it's being paid for. Now, the fact that it's giving them a meal and a roof over their head and a bed doesn't diminish the fact that the resident is suffering from scabies that they wouldn't have been suffering if the nursing home had been more honest with regulators earlier on.
Right, and that may be compensable in a negligence claim, but it doesn't form the basis of a false claim.
No, this is more than negligence. This is intentional deception of the government. Hiding the logs from the surveyors so that they don't find out what nurses are actually saying to each other is not negligence.
Okay, it might be gross negligence.
No, it's not. It's beyond gross. It is intentional. Okay.
And that the focus of the claim is whether the government is getting no performance for its money. That's the core of a worthless services FCA theory. And the jury wasn't instructed properly on that theory of the claim. They weren't instructed that they had to find that the performance deficiencies were so grave that the government essentially got no performance for its money. And that's just not...
They were instructed that it had to be knowing, and that is how we distinguish this from a negligence case.
That's not the focus of the worthless service. I mean, all of these violations have to be knowing. That's the only way you can have liability under the False Claims Act. So that's not the core problem here. The core problem is the conceptualization of the worthless services fraud here, and we've never recognized this diminished value theory, first of all, in this circuit, and the circuits that have allowed this worthless services kind of claim to go forward have defined it as just as I've stated, which is not the way that it was defined for the jury in this case. They were allowed to find that they didn't have to find that the performance was essentially nullified, that the government got no performance for its money. And that's what the heart of a worthless services claim is.
Well, let me remind the court, the jury made independent findings on two different theories, false certification and worthless services.
Right, and I'm asking about the second now and whether
and
that
on
verdict
the second,
can stand.
If services have been knowingly provided and they've been provided such that the contractor knows that they are not worth what they were being charged, the intentionality submission of the
that's
claim...
That's not enough for a worthless services FCA claim. It's not just that they weren't worth exactly what was being paid.
But then the FCA would still allow damages that reflect the loss to the government.
No, that's a measure of loss. I'm talking about liability. The liability finding has to basically be that the government didn't get the performance that it paid for.
Right. And well, but that's why the Medicare, like many other government contracting systems, is replete with certifications to make sure that contractors know that when they tell the government how things are at the facility, they're doing so under pain of losing
Medicare
payments.
Medicaid is not analogous to other forms of government contracting where there will be a highly specific set of contract specifications built into the contract itself. Here you've got a heavily regulated industry and a regulatory compliance scheme that exists separate and apart from the FCA, and what's being done here is a substitution of a private set of plaintiffs for the regulatory authority on discrete regulatory failings.
Right. But, Your Honor, when you say it's heavily regulated but on the honor system. Medicare regulators do not inspect patients in actual services in order to test the truth of the records that they've been handed. So when Medicare surveyors gave Moments a clean bill of health, that's exactly what the records were sanitized to show them. It's not surprising if Medicare surveyors continued to allow the nursing home to be paid if the nursing home surveyors were deceived as to what the conditions were. And in that sense, it's a knowingly false certification.
What did the relators expose that the otherwise inspections didn't disclose?
None of the inspections were aware of the tactics to deceive the surveyors. They were not aware that logs were being hidden, that records were being falsified, that scabies and decubitus were going unrecorded, that there were false presentations of staffing and of the quality of facilities, and they did not disclose that the plans of correction that the nursing home developed were basically ignored. The testimony in 2002 was that Moments had submitted an extensive plan of correction and did absolutely nothing to execute it.
Now, one of the relators
did not know.
One of the relators' mother was there for 7 years, right?
Yes.
And she seemed to be all right.
Well, it was pretty much the only game in town. It was the one nursing home that people could go to at that point.
Yeah, but I guess what I have a problem here is they didn't close the place down. It wasn't so flagrant, and that people went there, stayed there, and did whatever. No one wants to be in a nursing home, and some are better than others. But I don't find out where the relators really expose something that they deserve some, I don't know what you want to call it, victory.
If Medicare had known what I just told you about the hiding of logs and the falsification of records, it would have been grounds for immediate termination from the program and denial of further payment, because that is not negligence. That is an action that undermines the integrity of the Medicare survey process.
Why didn't they just close it down when they discovered all of this?
They disclosed it when they filed the False Claims Act suit.
Yeah, then what? Did you close it down?
The nursing home was sold in 2006.
Well, does that mean it's no longer a nursing home?
Well, it's no longer operated by the defendants.
Was that a forced sale or voluntary sale?
I don't know.
I mean, that's just...
I mean, these are all arguments that the nursing home made to the jury, and the jury simply didn't believe them.
Well, I'm perplexed at what the jury did. What it looked like when the court presented it to the jury, he said, they'd never seen a case like this before, there's no precedent for it, and we'll just have to throw this in the jury's lap, see what they do. That seemed to be what happened. And I frankly look at these numbers and have a lot of trouble finding the foundation for it.
Well, this is always true in complex cases like antitrust cases or securities fraud cases, where a jury is given an immense amount of information and is simply instructed under the preponderance of the evidence to make a finding of a number. There's no requirement that they write the equivalent of a bench decision.
Usually there's a damages theory, though.
Right. Well, the damages theory here is that the jury could look to the billings during times in which the patient care was affected by the false certification. And even if you confine the case to the 2002 scabies epidemic, you're looking at more than 2,000 claims and more than $3 million in damages. And I'll turn it over to the U.S. Thank you very much.
Mr. Freeman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Mark Freeman for the United States. The government appreciates the opportunity to address the Court this morning. Judge Sykes, if I may just begin, I'd like to focus my presentation on the worthless services theory. This is a theory of some importance to the United States, both in this case and elsewhere. But just a targeted answer to your question, Judge, regarding the jury instructions. The defendants here, not only to my understanding, didn't object to the jury instructions as they were given, a focused objection, and then, of course, defendants usually do have to object to jury instructions they don't like, but they proposed their own jury instruction on worthless services. That's at page A837 of the record, which was, for all practical purposes, the same and would have allowed the jury, in this case, to return the same answer to verdict question number one that it did. Do you find that they knowingly provided worthless services? Answer, yes. Now, let me back up and talk a little bit about the worthless services theory. Worthless services is not a statutory term. It's not in the False Claims Act. What it is intended to do, the reason why people bring claims denominated worthless services, and I think the colloquy this morning illustrates why it is an unfortunate misnomer, is to get at the idea that this is not quibbling over the, like in the Mike's case in the Second Circuit, whether a spirometry test was exactly right when it was performed, whether the machines were appropriately calibrated. What a worthless services theory is a theory that it basically the claim was false because, like in the Civil War when we tried to buy horses and somebody sold us dying donkeys, here we tried to buy professional nursing services that included adequate sanitation, adequate nutrition, adequate medicine, and what the defendants actually sold us was not that. It was something woefully and grossly deficient. And that makes out a false claim if it was intentionally done, whether or not the remaining portion of what they sold us had any economic value. Just to give an example, suppose we contract, a more traditional example, suppose we contract to buy a tank, and we say, we want a tank that goes 45 miles an hour because the enemy tanks can go 30. And what is delivered to us is a tank, but it goes 15 miles an hour, and it was intentionally sold to us and passed off as a tank that could go 45. Well, in that circumstance, that is an intentional misrepresentation of the goods sold to us, even though a tank that can go 15 miles an hour may have economic value. That is the gist. That is the understanding.
Well, that's a breach of contract action. No, it's Your Honor, this is False Claims Act.
It is exactly
your example. Was there a certification that this?
If you knowingly pass off a product that is deficient in a material way, that is a False Claims Act action. This court said that in the main case, where the court said it is a well-known principle of private law that a promise to perform that is negligently broken is just a breach of contract. But a promise knowingly made with the intent not to perform is fraud. And that is the original paradigmatic case under the False Claims Act. If a government contractor says, we say...
Right, but that theory has some reasonable limiting principle or boundary when you're talking about other forms of government contracting, like the purchase of a tank that goes a certain...
Right, that's
miles per hour, but it's not really adaptable to this context.
But respectfully, Your Honor, we disagree. This is how the False Claims Act applies to a category of case of which we think this is an example, and maybe the court disagrees for reasons related to the particular presentation here, but this is important to the United States. A worthless services theory attempts to show that just like if we tried to buy services to guard an army base, and the people who they supplied were blind and couldn't guard an army base.
Another inapt analogy, well, counsel. I'm asking you for some limiting principle or boundary in the context of Medicare, Medicaid.
Oh, and then let me answer Your Honor.
So give it to me in that context. If we're going to recognize this theory in this context, we need some framework for it.
And the framework is the materiality and scienter requirements of the False Claims Act. So this is not a case, and if it were a case, we would not be supporting liability, in which some little violation of Medicare regulations is alleged to support a massive verdict like this. This is a case in which the theory of the case presented to the jury was they have been billing the United States for professional nursing services. And I think we can all agree that at some point, if what in fact they were doing was not providing professional nursing service, they didn't have any nurses at all, and people were just locked in a room, you would say that is fraud. If you intentionally...
Right, because that's the equivalent of no performance at all. And that's traditionally the boundary line for a worthless services theory. If it's tantamount to really no performance at all, then you can submit a claim to a jury on this theory.
Well, but the worthless services is not a statutory term. The statutory term is the knowing presentation of a false claim that is material. And if the difference between what they provided and what they said they would provide was both knowing and material, then it is a false claim. If you know it, if you say to us, we will give you professional nursing services that will include, at a minimum, the following things, then if you provide something that's very close and you don't knowingly do it differently, it's not a false claim. But if you knowingly fail to provide the gist of that bargain and it is a material difference, that is a false claim under the False Claims Act.
Well, what is the gist? I mean, they were paid for per diem nursing care, nursing home care,
right,
of patients. What is explain what the gist of what was missing here. I mean, the
basic sanitation and medication.
Basic sanitation?
Yes. Your Honor, that was absolutely the argument made to the jury. The defendants here made exactly the argument to the jury that Mr. Olson made this morning. What are you talking about? This is a couple of isolated incidents. This wasn't, we didn't knowingly fail to provide basic sanitation. And the jury was entitled on the evidence before to return the verdict that it did. And the Medicare regulations cited in our brief define, this is the quality of care regulations at 42 CFR 483 Part B, they define basic essence of a professional nursing services bargain. Now, if you violate one part of it or another part of it, Mr. Olson has mentioned the non-smoking provision. That doesn't make out a false claim, but other things in there do. They say things like, you have to, if you serve food, it has to be kept in a sanitary refrigerator. You have to provide the medicine that the people need. You can't put them into boiling water. These are basic things that we would think would be in any professional nursing home, and they are the things that the United States thought we were paying for when we got claims from Moments Meadows saying that they had provided these claims. And if they knowingly billed us for services that didn't meet those requirements, that's a false claim.
But the inspectors found those things. For instance, the person who put the patient in boiling water without first testing. That's obviously a huge error. I doubt they did that on purpose. She just didn't test the water before she did it, so it was bad and an injury. They got into the hospital and had to do treatment. And what I would worry about here is a precedent where it opens the door to a lot of people who can make a lot of charges about any existing nursing home.
And that's,
I don't think you want that.
And Your Honor, may I answer the question? I know I'm at the end of my time. Thank you. I agree that that's a concern. The United States agrees that that's a concern. And on that point, we would just commend to the court the discussion of the D.C. Circuit in the SAIC case, which grappled with this very problem and concluded that the answer is not to engraft limitations on the False Claims Act that are not in the statutory text, requirements of proof of conditions and things, words that the statute doesn't use. The answer is to enforce the materiality and scienter requirements aggressively. And in this case, that was exactly the argument. And to your point about the survey reports, it's true, as Mr. Olson says, that many of them found no problem at all, but that's because the operators of this nursing home hid from the surveyors the very things that make out the essence of the fraud. And of course, the energetic effort to hide that information is both a great demonstration of materiality. They knew something was wrong with what they were doing, that's why they were hiding it, and it's great evidence of intent.
Well, how long did that go on, the hiding of all this stuff?
I'm sorry?
How long did the concealment go on?
I believe the evidence in front of the jury was that it went on for quite a while, and Mr. Olson says that wasn't mentioned in the closing arguments. To the contrary, at page 1100 of the record, the relator's closing argument emphasized that whenever one of these inspectors came in to the nursing home, they went over the intercom and said, Mr. Graff, call on line 9. That was their code to say, hide all of the records so these people don't find it. That was in the closing arguments. The idea that this wasn't presented to the jury, I think, is just inconsistent with the trial.
Did the relators know of this the whole period of time?
I don't know the answer about the entire period.
The question I have is, they're just sitting here watching all this go on and then at the last minute blow the whistle?
And the jury clearly did not return a verdict that applied to the whole period of time. But if I may just two sentences here to conclude. The worthless services theory, Your Honor, if the court concludes it doesn't apply here, then we can't have any quarrel with the court's judgment. We think it does, but again, that's obviously the court's call. But we would ask the court be careful in how it addressed this theory, because it is of importance to the United States around the country in fighting a very fundamental problem with failure of care cases in nursing homes.
We're always careful.
I know. I appreciate that, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Olson. How much time? You've got 4 minutes. 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me return immediately then to the worthless services point. And I think you made the point, Judge Sykes, that the services would have to be equivalent to no performance at all. That is precisely on page A837 what the jury answered the instruction, the instruction given to the jury. The term false means, and it can, services are so deficient that for all practical purposes, it is the equivalent of no performance at all. The SAIC case, which the government just mentioned, is a case I'm familiar with because I argued that case, and the court specifically in deciding that case distinguished the Mikes case, for example, from other cases from this circuit because of the circumstances of false claims in the Medicare, Medicaid area. If you're going to allege that something is deficient, the service is deficient, Mr. Freeman mentioned the food. That one of the regulations says the food must be presented in an attractive way. Well, there are a zillion regulations with respect to this. No institution is perfect. So the system is set up to have this administrative procedure where people come out and look at the facility, decide what's wrong, decide how serious it is. There were fines imposed in a number of different instances. This is all in the record. The government was aware, the Illinois government was aware of the scabies incidents. There were 117 visits by the surveyors. 80 of them were without notice. So there wasn't any ability. 110 out of 117 were unannounced visits, and 80 of those surveys found no violations. So all those people showing up unannounced, finding various things, did not find violations. This is not a no performance at all situation. It is a place where there were defects found that were known to the government, which precludes this case altogether. And then we turn to the idea of concealment. That is not a, there was no, there were objections with respect to the way the court was presenting this. On pages A574 of the record, objections were made, and the counsel said it can create a violation of the False Claims Act for somebody at the nursing home to get scabies, or if there's any problem with the mixing value, blah, blah, blah. So there was concern about the fact that these objections were quite vague. The fact is that the jury was instructed in a way that it came up with a number that no one to this day can justify where that number came up with. They're talking about an 8-year period. Mr. Anderson said there were 2,000 of these MDS forms per year. Well, that would be 16,000 MDS forms, if his calculations are correct, I don't know whether they are, over the 8-year period, and the jury comes up with the 1,729. What is it related to? Which forms? What submissions to the government? How were they false? When were they done? These are important numbers. This is important to the institution, because you can destroy an institution and you can prevent nursing homes from existing, because they are dealing with very difficult patients and there are going to be problems with respect to them. There's been no argument at all with respect to Mr. Graff, and the evidence is fairly clear that he was not involved in the performance of submission of forms. He wasn't aware of them. He didn't sign them. That part of the verdict is entirely unjustified. And with respect to the retaliation claim, it may be a minor point, but the judge didn't even give an instruction under the False Claims Act. He gave an instruction under an Illinois statute that hadn't even been enacted at the time he gave that instruction. We submit that this is a case where there are allegations of defective care with respect to hundreds of patients over a long period of time. That is going to happen. The government is aware of it. That precludes the False Claims Act case. And under this court's precedence, none of the requirements for a False Claims Act have been met, because there have not been particularized submissions that were false. The MDA, MDS form, if you look at it carefully, it says we're describing accurately the system, the symptoms that the patients have. None of those were proven to be inaccurate, and it says that the information was collected in a manner consistent with the regulations. We submit this is a entirely unjustified verdict, is not justified by the False Claims Act, and should be overturned.
All right. Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.